even, I mean, sometimes only one amino acid, if that is absent from the diet of an aphid, one essential amino acid, it will grow totally differently. Sometimes aphid can live with one absent amino acid and they can grow fine. But if there are two absent or three absent, then that might have a significant effect on their growth. So it varies from aphid to aphid.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here with a bunch of people who are interested in insect and invertebrate conservation. To just one step further, I actually paid for a fair amount of my undergraduate education out of dumpsters. Truly amazing how many people throw away valuable stuff. And when you don't have a trust fund or many scholarships, you can find big TVs and bicycles and sell them. It's pretty amazing. But I don't do that anymore because I'm gainfully employed. So today I'm very excited to talk to you about how the ESA can work with the ESA to conserve insects. This is a topic that's close to my heart. And the reason it's close to my heart is because it's two things that I find very important: invertebrate conservation and the Endangered Species Act. I've worked on the Endangered Species Act and issues related to it for two decades. And I've worked on invertebrates for more than two decades, and I find that it is a very valuable tool. Now, Karen Oberhauser talked about tools. Citizen science is a tool. I think everybody's talking about tools today. Mace talked about a lot of tools, and I think we talked about birds as umbrellas for invertebrate conservation. All of these are different strategies and tools that we can use, and with the depth of the crisis that I think Sasha alluded to with the loss of insects and other invertebrates across the planet, I think we need all of these tools. You know, we can't just use birds, and we can't just use science and research, and we can't just use outreach. And that's, again, where the Endangered Species Act comes in. It's just one tool out of many in a toolbox that I think we need to work with. I want to give you a little background first on the Endangered Species Act. Congress passed the Endangered Species Act in 1973, and this is the only time I get to use quotes from Richard Nixon. It's great. This act was overwhelmingly popular back in 1973. Both Democrats and Republicans supported this act, and it was signed into law with actually pretty nice words by Richard Nixon. And it makes it a neat tool, I think, because when it was passed, and yes, there's a little rancor more now, but it was really a tool that everybody believed in, that we needed to protect these species. It really is one of the strongest environmental protection laws in the world, not just in this country. Most other countries do not have laws that specifically protect species and their habitat. And I want to iterate, there's a lot of confusion over the Endangered Species Act, that it protects species and we should be protecting ecosystems or areas or places. Well, actually, the Endangered Species Act, the purpose is to conserve imperiled species and, the important part, the ecosystems on which they depend. And that's the important piece of this act that I find compelling, is we're not just myopically looking at the species, we're looking at its ecosystems and trying to look at the different functions within those ecosystems and how we work to protect them. I love this picture of the American burying beetle larva. Anybody who can identify what they're eating, I will buy a beer, because I've looked at this for a long time and it's just an undifferentiated glob of goo at this point. But they're so clean. Isn't that neat? The Endangered Species Act really has three parts. The first one is to classify or list endangered and threatened species. People think about that part a lot. The second part is to designate critical habitat for these listed species to protect, again, the ecosystems that they rely on. And the third is to develop recovery plans for these species so that they won't remain on the list, to recover them off of this list back into a functioning species that doesn't need our help. It's a precautionary statute in that it errs on the side of protecting species in the face of scientific uncertainty. There was debate on the floor of the House of Representatives about how we should not study these species until they were extinct. We've done that before. Now it's time to protect species, even if we're not sure, but we think that they're declining. We have evidence that they're declining. We should protect them. I'm not sure that debate on the House floor goes, is that intelligent anymore, but maybe it is. Maybe it is. There's no other law in the U.S. that specifically, that's a hard word, specifically protects invertebrates and their habitat. Now, there are other laws that protect habitat. There are other laws that protect animals, like the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and maybe protecting birds, I think, is a good tool to protect insects. But there's no other law to specifically protect invertebrates, national law. Now, there's some state laws that do provide some protection, but they're very variable. Some states protect invertebrates, but almost none protect habitat. They protect them from take, but not habitat. Some states, oddly enough, protect certain invertebrates. New Mexico, you can list a crustacean, but you can't list an insect. Not exactly sure why. And most states, though, don't protect invertebrates at all under their state laws. So just a little background on insects. The first invertebrate listed was the shell swallowtail in April of 76, followed by 6 butterflies in California and 20 Appalachian mussels. Appalachian mussels because of all the issues with damming in the Appalachians. I'm going to get a little drink of water here. Now, people had data slides. I've got a couple data slides, not anything really hard to see. Just to give you an idea of the species that are listed under the Endangered Species Act, or the numbers, there are 57 insect species listed at present. And to talk about this disparity that some folks talk about, it's interesting. 57 species out of hundreds of thousands of named species is a very small fraction of what potentially is actually endangered out there. This is just a list of listing over time. You can see that 76 was the first year insects were included. 81 was a big year. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was working with somebody named Paul Oppler. A lot of those are butterflies, but also a lot of the mussels were listed that year. The 80s were kind of a lull, 90s were pretty big, and early 2000s were very depauperate of insect listings. 2006 is a big bump because 12 of those species are picture-winged flies in Hawaii. In 81, Congress revised the ESA. There were concerns about the Endangered Species Act from some lawmakers that insects should not be included in the endangered species law. The House of Representatives actually at that point tried to take insects out of the law. The Senate came up with a compromise that insects should be included, but they should be differentiated from other species. So insects are the only group that can't be protected if they are deemed that they could be a pest, which is interesting because birds can be pests, but they could be listed. Fish could be pests, I suppose. They could be listed. So it is interesting. And they're the only group that you cannot list a distinct population segment. Many of our animals have distinct population segments listed. Insects, you have to have a full subspecies to list. So a bit of a disparity there under the Endangered Species Act. Now, how does it work, though? Basically, there are 5 main tenets to the Endangered Species Act. It provides immediate protection to habitat on federal land. So any endangered species that's found on Forest Service or BLM land, Bureau of Land Management, or some other federal land gets protection. They have to manage it for its recovery. It provides for consultation when a permit is needed. Basically, if you're building a big development or you're filling in a wetland and you have to get a federal permit, you have to get authorization from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service if there's an endangered species there. You actually have to do extra review to ensure that the project you're doing does not impact those species. This is what's interesting, and I want to differentiate from normal landowners that are just going about day-to-day business. The federal government is not swooping in on normal landowners and telling them what they can and cannot do with their endangered species. What it's doing is, if you have to get a federal permit, then you have to go through a review process. It also provides, and this is something we work with a lot, provides landowner incentives to protect habitat. There's quite a bit of money out there to protect habitat for endangered species on private lands, as there should be. Over 50% of our endangered species are on private lands, and with that, we have to be working with private landowners to do that. There's a provision to guard against take, and take is to kill, maim, harass. I like harass, you know, we're going to go out and harass these endangered species. And this is one, when I talk with my entomologist friends, that causes some consternation and some concern because of that take. So just to dispel, I think, hopefully, a couple issues. Basically, if you're out collecting and you accidentally take an endangered species, As far as I know, and I'm never going to say never, there's never been an issue where anybody's gotten in trouble. This take provision is really for collectors who are trying to sell these for profit. If you accidentally collect an endangered species, contact us or contact your local U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service office. Let them know. It's happened in teaching collections or in student collections, I know, several times, and we've contacted them and they've been fine. Also, you can get a permit to do take for scientific studies, and that's what's important. You can still work on these species, you just have to think about your study plan and how it would, one, not imperil these species, and two, how it might aid in recovery. So the take provision is important, but we as entomologists can really work with that provision, I believe. The other important thing is it provides funds for research. We worked on the Salt Creek tiger beetle, and once it was listed, we were able to get funding both for research and for acquisition of habitat. These are two things that nobody was willing to fund in the Salt Creek tiger beetle because it was a beetle. All of a sudden, it's listed, and people are, you know, here's $100,000. Let's buy some habitat. This is a very important law because of the research component and habitat acquisition. I don't need to belabor the Delhi Sands flower-loving fly, but if you've ever been in a meeting and you're sticking up for a fly and most of the people in the audience have giant fly swatters, it's a little disconcerting. And I think the lessons are that we need to do a better job with these invertebrates. Flies are thought of as not appealing, and this fly is in an area where land values are extreme up in Riverside County, and there's a lot of money to be made, and this fly is standing in the way of people making a lot of money. There's a lot of consternation over that. But we need to do a better job about talking about how this fly is protecting the last of the Delhi Sands dunes. It's protecting this habitat that if it goes, it's gone, and it's unique. It's not just about the fly. Just very quickly on another lesson, the lotus blue and the birdwing pearly mussel. They were both listed within a month of each other. They were both on the most endangered list in 1980. The birdwing pearly mussel is recovering very nicely, and the lotus blue is probably extinct. Here's the issue. We should be trying to work on these species before they're at the brink of extinction. Even though the pearly mussel was critically endangered, it had several good populations that we could work with to expand and recover. The lotus blue did not. It just continued to decline. We need to get to these species before there's, you know, 10 of them left. So policy, ESA and the ESA. The ESA can be, I think, a very positive force, similar to what conservation Society for Conservation Biology and the Ecological Society of America as a policy body to let Congress know that this is an important law and that we should protect it. We should make sure that the ESA maintains the precautionary statute because it's vitally important. We're scientists and we want to study things, but we should protect things that we know with data need to be protected
and then figure out how to recover them and not study them to death. Oh, wait, can I back up? How do I back up, Mace? Up arrow. Okay. This is so cool. Doesn't he look like he's going to kiss you? He's great. This is Malone's jumping slug. This is the picture of the eggs that Mace had. Malone's jumping slug is an obligate to old growth in the Pacific Northwest. And it's cool. It's a slug and it jumps. I just think that is so neat. And it's evolved to jump because its main predator is a predatory snail. And the snail is like a hound dog where it sniffs out slime trails. And then it follows the slime trails and it's really fast. Well, for a snail. It's not really fast, but it's fast. And it's faster than most slugs and snails in the Pacific Northwest. So it basically, I'm getting some footage of this where it's just this slow motion and then they catch up and it engulfs it. It's just really neat. But when it catches up to the jumping slug jumps. It's evolved to separate itself from its slime trail and jump. It actually jumps up and corkscrews away. And then the predatory snail is left there without its slime trail to smell and doesn't have its meal. So I just think a jumping slug. We also need to work to ensure adequate funding of ESA. It's something that's been lacking in the Endangered Species Act. It's underfunded constantly. And it's something that the Ecological Society of America could work on to try to get the federal government to actually fund this important tool. And then we really need to increase awareness about invertebrates in general. When we go in and I have a meeting and I'm working on a snail and 20 of them can fit on my fingernail, they're not very charismatic. Some things we work on are not going to be charismatic. We can't always work on charismatic things. They're important, and I think John Losey is going to talk about why these things are important coming up because of their ecosystem services. And last, if you're working on at-risk populations or you're working on systematics or you're Chris who's doing taxonomy and understanding these species, any of this information should be, if we can, try to use it and provide it to agencies to help them with their recovery efforts. The people at the agencies are underfunded, overtaxed. The more we can help them, the more that they can.